Chapter 2. New Recruits. Those who know no will but His, take His hand, and from the night He leads to light. Mary Baker Eddy. 1888. Ebenezer J. Foster, M.D., had accompanied Mrs. Eddy to Chicago, along with Captain and Mrs. Eastman and Calvin Fry, but he had not returned with the party to Boston. The doctor had a brother residing in the Great Lakes area, so following the convention, he had gone on to Wisconsin for a fraternal visit. Dr. Foster had first presented himself at Mrs. Eddy's college the previous fall, just before her son George Glover turned up on her doorstep. The two men were about the same age, but unlike in every other respect. George was totally disinterested in his mother's work, and was a hindrance and an embarrassment to her. Foster, on the other hand, was a sincere seeker after truth and an eager pupil. After attending the November 1887 primary class at the college, he had returned to his home in Vermont, had abandoned his homeopathic practice, and begun the practice of Christian Science. He looked upon Mrs. Eddy as his adopted mother, and his letters to her were those of a dutiful son. In a time of great need, the leader had solicited the assistance of her son George in vain. Now, in this present crisis, she again felt the desirability of a son's assistance, but her thoughts turned to Ebenezer Foster rather than to George Glover. He had come to her college in the spirit of honest investigation and had seen the great value of the truth she was teaching. His training and experience were largely in the field of medicine, which could be an asset to the obstetrical department of her college if the rebellious faction sought to make trouble. And there was no doubt of his genuine talent in many directions. She sent a telegram to him in Wisconsin, asking him to come to Boston. Dr. Foster responded immediately, arriving in Boston on Wednesday, July 4th, the day for the regular CSA meeting, which had been canceled due to the holiday. His teacher talked to him of all the work resting on her shoulders, of how she felt he could help her with it. And for this purpose, she invited him to become a part of her household. Dr. Foster was a bachelor in his early 40s with no family obligations. His mother was deceased. After studying, he had openly and eagerly embraced Christian Science. The leader's offer was a marvelous opportunity for an eager young man, and he accepted it without hesitation. In the early spring of 1888, Sarah H. Cross was the manager of the Christian Science Journal, and the street address given for the Christian Science Publishing Society on the front cover of the journal was the address of Sarah Cross's Christian Science Institute, 19 Berwick Park. Before summer, Mrs. Cross was the leader of the rebellion. By July, there was a new journal manager, and the Publishing Society address printed on the journal cover was that of the Metaphysical College on Columbus Avenue. Mrs. Eddy appointed Frank Mason, manager of the journal, and she asked William B. Johnson to find out what the dissenters were planning so that she could take the necessary steps to protect her work and her cause. A notice on the inside front cover of the August Journal exposed some of their activities. Special notice. Owing to the fact of a large distribution of circulars, giving address of journal at 19 Berwick Park, we beg leave to inform the public that Mrs. Sarah H. Cross has resigned as manager of the Christian Science Journal and is no longer a member of the Christian Science Publishing Society. The present address is at 571 Columbus Avenue. See notice on page 270 of this issue. On the 29th of July, Mrs. Eddy delivered a sermon to her church at Chickering Hall, which warned of the great danger of self-inflicted wounds when handling fragments and splinters instead of the whole vessel of truth. Dr. Foster sang a solo at this church service, the final meeting before an August recess. Mrs. Eddy had talked with Foster about a vacation in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, and also about her very fine students, Mr. and Mrs. Ira Oscar Knapp, who resided in that area. Foster had written something of their plans to Mr. Knapp on the 18th of July, stating, quote, "Mother said something about going to your house a few days then, but she did not authorize me to say anything about it, and perhaps it was only a passing thought," end quote. It had been nearly 3 years since Mrs. Eddy's identity as the woman of the apocalypse had been revealed to Ira Oscar Knapp, and they had been years spent in study, practice, and pondering, resulting in great metaphysical growth and more than a little resistance and reaction in the community. When Mrs. Eddy stepped off the train in Lyman, New Hampshire, on August 20th, on her way to visit the Knapp farm, she looked around for a moment and then remarked, "What a narrow little town." Local citizens had recently hanged her in effigy in their town square, and they had depicted her as insane and caged in their Independence Day parade. The resistance to the progressive revealings of truth is well nigh inconceivable. Before Mrs. Eddy's visit, two things of significance had occurred in the Knapp family. First was a vision of a strange street scene, which Ira Knapp saw repeatedly. He was accustomed to studying out of doors in the shade of a spreading butternut tree with his books on a large rock. And while studying there, he saw clearly a brilliantly lighted city street. This vision recurred many times. It was always the same street, always very clear, and he saw it in the daytime when he was wide awake. When he told Mrs. Eddy about it after her arrival, she was deeply interested and said, "I understand." The second significant occurrence had culminated in Mr. and Mrs. Knapp's pending trip to Boston, which they had gladly canceled. The father of one of their neighbors had approached them regarding trading their farm for a house he owned in Roslindale, and their trip to inspect the house had been scheduled for the morning of Mrs. Eddy's arrival. When their guest learned of these arrangements, she insisted that they make the trip to Boston as planned, and 18-year-old Daphne Knapp cared for the guests and managed the house until her parents' return. Within 2 weeks, the Knapps exchanged their farm for the Roslindale House. Ira Knapp had been a trader all his life, but he often said in after years that he had nothing to do with this trade. God did it. One Saturday evening, a short time later, Ira Knapp arrived at the North Station in Boston en route to his new home in Roslindale. Walking across the common to catch the train from the old Providence Station in Park Square, he reached an elevation with a view down Columbus Avenue, the street on which the Massachusetts Metaphysical College was located. The street lamps had just been lighted, and there before him, Mr. Knapp recognized unmistakably the street of his vision. It was not long before he opened an office for Christian Science work on this very street. There was another student the leader would have liked to bring to her aid, and that was Reverend Joseph Adams. She must have felt toward him much as Jesus felt when he said, quote, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not." End quote. Adams had first studied with Mrs. Eddy in her March 1886 class, and his grasp of Christian Science was far beyond that of the average student of that day. His statements were clear and forthright, although his zeal at times exceeded his wisdom. But the stumbling block was his refusal to accept direction from the leader. He was determined to go his own way. When rebuked by her, he had reacted by issuing his own publication, the Chicago Christian Scientist, in June of 1887. Unlike the many other Christian Science periodicals then extant, his magazine supported Mrs. Eddy and her discovery. In his October 1887 issue, he had written an article entitled, "It Will Not Mix. Please Call Things by Their Right Name. What we mean is this. Don't call mind cure, faith cure, psychical healing, occult science, psychology, mind reading, or psychometry, magnetism, orthodox Christian Science, Christian theosophy, spiritualism, or any other ism by the name of Christian Science. Some of my friends and students have been told again and again, quote, they are all the same or simply different names given to different phases of the same thing," end quote. But those who say such things are either in utter ignorance of what Christian Science is, or they do not sufficiently understand it, so as to discriminate between Christian Science and the many claimants to that name, or they are guilty of deception for mercenary purposes. We don't like to think of anyone being guilty of the latter, but we have seen and heard of some things of late which compels us to make a demand for honesty. Christian Science is the name which the Reverend Mary B.G. Eddy gave to her system of treating sin and sickness, which system of treatment she has given after much patient, persevering, and self-denying labor to the public in her book entitled Science and Health. We have studied Christian Science as expounded in Science and Health, and also the other things named, which claim to be equivalent to it, and find ourselves utterly unable to mix them. Christian Science is not eclectic. It is preeminently exclusive. If Mrs. Eddy and her system of treating sin and disease is in error, as I am hearing almost every day, and such denunciations against her that I will not stir up feeling by naming them, will someone please explain why those very same persons cling with such tenacity to her name and palm themselves off as Christian Scientists, while they disclaim against it and withhold in their professed teaching of Christian Science the most important part of it? Beloved, I am not writing under the influence of feeling or making an attack upon any personality, but combating a grievous error, which is greatly perplexing inquirers after truth, doing nobody any good, and which can be destroyed by the practice of the royal law. Quote, "Do unto others as you would that others should do to you." End quote. Joseph Adams could have been of great assistance to the founder of Christian Science if he had ceased his eclectic studies and applied himself exclusively to science. After the National Christian Scientist Association meeting in Chicago in the summer of 1888, he published Mrs. Eddy's address, given extemporaneously at the Central Music Hall, as the lead article in his July 1888 issue, with a brief but excellent preface. In the fall, as Mrs. Eddy was scanning the horizon, seeking loyal students to support her in her work, Joseph Adams once again came forth with a fearless defense of his teacher and her uncovering of hypnotism, more commonly called mesmerism at that time. This lead article read in part as follows. Common honesty. We must insist upon it. Every little while we meet with persons who claim to be teachers or demonstrators of Christian Science. But when we get to know their beliefs, they utterly repudiate a most important part of it, that is, its teachings on the subject of mesmerism. We readily acknowledge that the principle of Christian Science is truth, and truth is as old as God, for it is God, and God belongs to all, for He is our Father, so that no one person or any number of persons have any exclusive right to God. But the name Christian Science is not old, for all who know anything of the subject will admit that the name Christian Science originated with Mary B.G. Eddy, and that name stands as the representative of a system or method of divine healing, which includes instruction in the nature, mode of operation, and way by which that subtle belief of the carnal mind can be effectually overcome. Instruction in that part of the system of healing is not an indifferent or optional thing, but an important and essential part of it. And to leave it out would be equivalent to the omission of instruction in addition or subtraction in the principle of mathematics, and then call it arithmetic. If competent teachers or students misrepresent the true teachings on that subject, that is no fault of the system, any more than Jesus is to blame for the many who misrepresent his teachings and call themselves Christians. If you proclaim yourself a Christian Scientist, the public will expect you to give them all that is involved in Christian Science, or you will be a cheat, for you will keep back part of the price. Please do not be offended or misunderstand us. We are not asking you to deify or worship anyone's personality, but simply pleading for common honesty. Neither do we ask you to credit Mrs. Eddy with more than what belongs to her. Our views of holding up anyone's personality for admiration may be offensively radical to some, but we cannot help it. It is not our desire to offend the least of God's children, but we must confess according to our views of Christian Science that any effort, the tendency of which is to fix our attention upon the personality of any public benefactor, rather than upon the principles of truth which they proclaim, is not only unscientific, but positively idolatrous. We know something of Mrs. Eddy, and unless we have misjudged her altogether, she would not thank us for holding up her personality as an object of admiration. And we have no sympathy with any effort in that direction. If there is one thing she impressed upon our mind while passing through her classes, more than another, it was this: not to look at Mrs. Eddy, but to the truth which she declared. Adam's article elicited this response from the teacher. 385 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Mass., October 3rd, 88. Reverend Joseph Adams, dear student, the leading article in your magazine was needed and will do good. It is only by laying bare the atrocities of animal magnetism and malicious mental malpractice that the human race can be saved from a bondage that will so far exceed the history of the Israelites in Egypt as the power of sin exceeds the inertia of matter to cause suffering. My personality, asserted and aimed at by others, has been under my feet 22 years. But the foes of Christ, marshaled under the signals of Christian Scientists, seem to see my personality very vividly and are constantly firing at it, although they never hit me. They conclude that I must come down because I make my personality bigger than theirs. Yet they will tell you they do not believe in personality. True, I have troublesome friends who burden themselves with personality, but I have scientific students who follow my teachings and leave my personality alone, more alone than any others on the globe. For this, I thank God and take courage. Yours in Christ, M. B. G. Eddy. The leader did thank God for the faithful few she could depend upon in the fall of 1888. Would that she could have included Joseph Adams in that small group, but he would not. He did continue for 2 or 3 years with strong support of Mrs. Eddy and Christian Science in his Chicago Christian Scientist. In one issue, he wrote, "Are you supplied with Mrs. Eddy's works? See cover of this magazine. If you are able to purchase all, do so, for their possession will be worth more to you than the richest Colorado mine. That is, if you work the books as the miner does the mine." In another issue, he published a letter from Mrs. Eddy, which stated, "I have examined your sermons, published, have read your magazine, and am ready to certify publicly or privately that what you write presents the truths of Christian Science with much clearness and Christian fervor." Right as he was at times, outspoken and fearless, still she could not count upon him to follow her instructions, nor to accept her advice. She could command Adams's good articles, but his independence and impetuosity resisted criticism or correction, and would in time cause him to deny the Christ. This was borne out later, when in August of 1891, Mrs. Eddy criticized a faulty article. Adams immediately renamed his publication the Chicago Truth Gleaner, gradually abandoned the principles he had been espousing, and soon disappeared from the scene. But she could rejoice, and did, to have Dr. Foster and Mr. and Mrs. Ira Knapp working with her in Boston. And though she foresaw the unreliableness of Reverend Adams, she still had hope for Reverend Day. Early in September, the Knapps were busy moving to their new home in Roslindale, while Dr. Foster was being prepared for his new role as assistant to Mrs. Eddy in the Metaphysical College. A card in the September journal read as follows. "Dear reader, allow me to introduce to you my assistant in obstetrics at the Massachusetts Metaphysical College, E. J. Foster, M.D., C.S.B. Dr. Foster will teach the anatomy and surgery of obstetrics, and I its metaphysics. The combination of his knowledge of Christian Science with his anatomical skill renders him a desirable teacher in this department of my college. In 20 years' practice, he has not had a single case of mortality at childbirth. He graduated from the Hahnemann Medical College in Philadelphia, March 1869. He was a member of the clinics of the Blockley Hospital and the Pennsylvania Hospital, allopathic institutions, 2 years, and was 1 year in Dr. Keene's Philadelphia School of Anatomy and Surgery. He was a member of the Vermont State Homeopathic Medical Society. During the past 2 years, he was chairman of the Bureau of Materia Medica. A class in obstetrics will commence in October term, 3 weeks. Students will receive the combined instruction of Mrs. Eddy and Dr. Foster for $200 tuition. Mary B. B.G. Eddy. The September Journal also announced the first Christian Science reading room. The location in the Hotel Boylston was to be a new home for the journal, but the article goes on to say, at first the plan was to have one room only, but it was later decided to hire two and take down the partition between them, thus making one spacious apartment. Not only will this be a publication room for our journal and a sales room for other Christian Science publications, but it will also be a reading room and social place for our friends, a sort of club room. And one reason for having so large a place is to afford room for the conference and other meetings of the Boston Church of Christian Scientists, and also for the sessions of the Christian Science Association. In an article entitled Truth versus Error, Mrs. Eddy answered many of the accusations being hurled against her, and two or three other articles in this September issue were in defense of their teacher. The malignity of the attacks is revealed in one statement by a student. Namely, scientists have received letters threatening their lives if they did not renounce the discoverer. Mrs. Eddy tried to answer specific accusations which were spreading like wildfire, but one short paragraph in her four-page article transcended the work of the mental arsonists then and remains a great inspiration today. Quote, God is responsible for the mission of those whom he has anointed. Those who know no will but his, take his hand, and from the night he leads to light. None can say unto him, what doest thou? End quote. As always, she was lifted above the fiery darts the wicked were aiming at her, and on the 17th of September began leading a large class of students to new spiritual heights. Nearly 100 had applied for instruction, but many were disappointed, for less than half were accepted. One of the fortunate 45 to be included in the September primary class was a professional singer from Canada named Clara Shannon. She began her reminiscences, quote, golden memories by one who is grateful to be able to testify to the truth about our beloved and revered leader, end quote. Miss Shannon recorded the following event. One day, when she had finished her lesson in the class, of which I was a member, she asked me to wait after the other members had gone, and as she was standing in the classroom at 571 Columbus Avenue, a gentleman called to see her, bringing with him his sister, who greatly needed healing. Mrs. Eddy met them at the door of the room and asked him to wait downstairs while she talked with his sister. The belief was insanity, and she looked terrified. Our leader told me her delusion was that a serpent was coiled around her body and was crushing her. I stood in amazement, watching Mrs. Eddy's face as she turned and looked at the woman who fell on the floor screaming, quote, it's crushing me. It's killing me, end quote. Our leader looked upwards, as if she had seen the face of an angel in her communion with God, In a moment, she said to the woman, "Has it gone?" But there was no reply. Mrs. Eddy repeated her question, but the woman still seemed not to hear it. Then she spoke with authority and asked, "Has it gone?" And the poor woman looked up, and her whole body was shaken and quivering as she answered, "Yes." I watched the changes of expression that came over her face, from fear to peace and joy. And oh, the love that was expressed in our leader's face as she looked down on her, stretched out both arms, and lifted her up, saying, "Get up, darling." Then our dear teacher took that needy one's head on her shoulder and patted her face as she lovingly talked the truth to her. Mrs. Eddy then went out of the room and talked to the brother, who took her home and then asked me to come and have supper with her and to sing to her. During the evening, she turned to me and said, "You saw what happened to that lady today? Well, she will never be insane in this world again." And she has not been. Early in October, the obstetrics class convened. The anatomical aspect was taught by Dr. Foster in the first 5 lessons, and in the last 4, metaphysical obstetrics was taught by the president, Mrs. Eddy. Practicing students from all over the nation, 33 from nearly as many states, convened for this course. Among their number was the Reverend George Day from Chicago. For over 20 years, the discoverer had hoped that Christian ministers would carry the banner of Christian Science. Many had been interested, sincere students, but one after another they had failed her. As she read Reverend Day's thoughts in the classroom, she saw that he too would soon defect. In October following the course, she wrote to him, "My pain and disappointment at seeing your state of mind is better imagined than described. Old theology and the schools cling to you to such an extent that I fear you will leave us eventually, and then you may be tempted to do as malicious mind prompts all to do. Take with you many of my best students who are not watching. To guard against this sadder result, this is my present petition. In all love and respect, proffer to you. If you feel that Christian Science, as laid down in Science and Health, is not what is genuine, you cannot surely feel justified in promulgating it. Therefore, I ask, yea, I beg you to resign your place now in this field to someone who is sound in this science, and let us still be friends, and you a fair foe, if indeed you must be this, to the truths of Christian Science. Please ponder this in your heart alone, and name it not. Go to God alone for wisdom, to enable you to deal with this subject justly. And as you would love to contemplate your action in time to come." Despite the disappointment clergymen were to her, she never ceased reaching out to them. 2 more were given free tuition to the primary class, which convened on Monday morning, the 12th of November, and which proved to be a most memorable course. This class experienced a Pentecostal hour, and for the first time, the 12-day course was completed in 7 days. The teacher offered to sit with them for 5 more days if they wanted, because the course had always taken 12 days, but she had given them all in just 7. Following dismission, she wrote, on November 22nd, to a promising new student, Julia Field King, M.D., who had been in the September class with Clara Shannon. I long to get some of those students in my late classes, well qualified for important posts in this great work that is being so abused by the charlatanism of this period. I want to hear from you by letter occasionally. And dear Mrs. Boughton, I wish, oh so much, that her dear husband had been in my last primary. I had a Methodist clergyman in Boston in it, and a D.D. from the West. They tell me that one day was a Pentecostal hour. It certainly was a very remarkable occasion. I felt the power of God lifting me up, and you know the scripture saith in the words of Jesus, when I am lifted up, I will draw all men unto me. It was not uncommon for Mrs. Eddy to teach a child together with his parent or parents, and 2 of the 30 students in the November primary class were 12-year-old Frank Bailey and his father, Joshua. Joshua P. Bailey had been a successful man of the world who had lost both his fortune and his health. At this turn of events, back in New York, he came upon Christian Science and was restored to health by Mrs. Eddy's devoted student, Augusta Stetson. This led him to the founder, and in the classroom, Mrs. Eddy found another dedicated disciple. She soon brought Mr. Bailey to Boston to edit the journal. For many months, the leader had been seeking to find the way midst all the treason and desertion. The day before this class began, Sunday morning, November 11th, Mrs. Eddy had a third vision relating to Science and health. The true previous visions had occurred 12 or 13 years earlier, and she related all three to her November class. The first vision was of a terrible, sensuous man. In the second, this man had torn part of the spotless garment from the beautiful babe in her arms and dragged it in the mire. In the latest vision, she saw herself again with the child in her arms. It was stripped naked now, with the garments all gone. She was standing on a precipice with a high ledge in front of her that was so high she could not climb with the child in her arms. She must go higher. She could not turn back, move either to the right or left. The way was so narrow. So she dropped the child at her feet and held it by one finger. At first, our leader thought that this was the end, that the truth she had labored so long and hard to bring to mankind was to be crucified once more. But as she pondered the message, it became the beginning of a new approach in her work for the world. Her babe, of course, was the divine revelation, science and health. Was not her movement, her cause, the child's garments? And had not they been stripped away by the rebellion in June? She had reached out to her few loyal students to help save her cause. Dr. Foster had been very helpful then, and even more so since that time. The obstetric class in October, wherein he had taught the first 5 lessons and she the last 4, had been a great success. He had also been of much assistance in her home. Perhaps he could help to carry the burden of the movement and give her some relief. She longed for such support, and she desired to reward his sincere efforts liberally. But most important of all, she saw in this sincere, dedicated young man a potential leader of her mighty movement. Someone who, after training and spiritual development, could take over the reins and allow her to step down. In order to make their relationship a closer one, by mutual agreement, she legally adopted Ebenezer J. Foster in the fall of 1888. On November 5th, his name became Foster Eddy. But the revelator to this age was not to be allowed to look to man for support. Much as she longed for human aid and comfort, she would be forced to turn to God alone for help, strength, and guidance.